Welcome to Dead Pilot Society, the show that takes comedy pilots from A-list writers that were sold and developed at networks but never produced and gives them the table reads they never got a chance to have. I am Andrew Reich, the creator and host of Dead Pilot Society. It is the second and final week of Max Fun Drive, the one time of year where all of the shows on the Maximum Fun Network reach out to you, our beloved listeners, and ask you to become members or to renew or upgrade your membership and to make these shows possible. This is the after show for Greatest American Heroes, and it features my interview with Andy Bobrow, writer and producer on Community, Last Man on Earth, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, etc. You are here for the after show, which means you really like Dead Pilot Society. It means you're interested in the interviews we do with the creators of these dead pilots. You're not just interested in hearing the table reads, you're interested in hearing the writer's stories about breaking into the TV business, navigating staffing, and working their way up to the point where they can sell a pilot that can eventually be read on this podcast. So that means that this show has value to you, and I'm going to be asking you to support it. So you're going to be hearing from me more than usual this episode. I'm going to talk about all the cool gifts and rewards you can get for becoming a member. And the reasons why, if you're listening, especially if you're listening to this after show, you should really consider supporting us by going to MaximumFun.org/join. I'll be back in a bit, but for now, enjoy my interview with Andy Bobrow.
All right. Here with Andy Bobrow.
All right.
Whose name I know how to say. Andy, I'm excited about this because... I've known your name, although I didn't know how to pronounce it, but I've known your name for quite a while, but we didn't get to meet until doing your pilot, and you've worked on a lot of things that I'm excited to talk to you about.
Oh, you're too kind.
So I'm just curious, I don't know anything about you. Where are you from, and how did you get started as a TV writer?
I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. Went to school there, Michigan State University, started out in advertising. Out of college, you know, I had two skills going into college. One was that I could play the tuba, and the other was that I could write funny stuff. And I actually majored in music for a year and a half, and then decided that wasn't my calling. And got an English degree. The ever
did you play tuba?
I played tuba.
Did you play tuba in a
concert band. In a brass band, yeah, and also in the marching band.
Okay.
So I was a band geek.
Okay. So you played sousaphone and tuba?
Oh yeah, yeah. I still go back once a year for alumni band day. It's hilarious. But that's not what we're here to talk about. No, so I had went from college to what you do, I think, in the Midwest, if you're kind of clever and can write, I got a job in advertising. And I did that, and that was really my first career, and I did it for like 15 years or so. And that moved me out to L.A. I worked at a couple different ad agencies in Detroit, and I came out to L.A., just because I really wasn't thinking Hollywood per se. I just wanted to be in a bigger market, a bigger city. I just wanted to spread my wings a little. And I worked
and
at.
Were you working at one of the big?
Yeah, I worked
firms
at
out here?
A place here called Campbell Ewald, which had Chevrolet and Princess Cruise Lines. What else did we have at Campbell Ewald? It's not going to be the most interesting part of this interview.
And then any campaigns that we would know? Nothing iconic. You're not the Where's the Beef?
I didn't do Where's the Beef. I never did a Super Bowl commercial. I did a lot of work for Acura. I mean, I could describe car commercials to you, and you'd go, "Oh yeah, I think I saw that," but that's because it was a car commercial. From there, a few years after living here and starting to think that it might be possible to work in entertainment in a bigger way, And I met a guy at work who said, who had taken improv classes at the Groundlings. And he said it was fun. And I had always kind of wanted to see if I could do that. And so I just started taking improv classes. And it was fun. It was terrifying and it was fun. And also at that, in that program, you know what, actors will say like that it's kind of cutthroat there, that the world of improv, people coming up in aspiring improvisers are like, it's an oddly competitive world and it scares a lot of people away. But for me, what ended up happening was the improv stuff I was terrible at and did scare the hell out of me. And being on stage with, I was no good at that. But the more classes you take there, the more you get into the writing and sketch writing, which right. I was good at. Because in my ad career, I kind of had started to specialize in radio commercials. This was back when people made radio commercials. And radio commercials are little 60-second sketches. And I loved doing it because people left me alone and I could just be dumb and write little bits and make people laugh. And I was in charge, you know, it was good. It was a good career. But it was at the Groundlings that I met some people who were further along in their careers. And one of them, you know, I was in a cast in the Sunday show at the Groundlings. I was in a cast with a bunch of people before they were famous, including Will Forte and Maya Rudolph, Cheryl Hines, Rachel Harris, Jim Rash, Nat Faxon. God, I'm probably missing other people who went on to have big careers, and a lot of other, you know, very talented people whose names you wouldn't know, but who have, you know, gone on and become writers. And Forte and Will had worked as a writer. He hadn't done SNL yet, but he had gotten some work as a writer, and he just we hit it off, and he thought I was funny, and he introduced me to his agent. Actually, Will said, "Have you ever thought about doing writing for TV?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. I've got a pretty good thing going here." I was afraid to say yes. Right. he was so sweet. And then he introduced me to his agent, and his agent said, "Well, I don't really need." He said, "Will says you're funny, so that's good for me. But you got to send me something. You got to give me something I can sell." And then it took me quite a while to get a spec script. His assignment for me was not to write a spec, write an original pilot. And he said, "Don't reinvent the wheel. Just do a version of Friends, but, you know, make it in your style. Do your voice. Let people know, you know, how you entertain people, what makes you laugh," which was, I thought, pretty good advice. And it took me quite a while. I tried and failed. You know, I sent him the first thing I sent him. He said, "I'm not going to show this to anyone."
But that was really it sounds like that was like the first real script for television that you had ever written. No.
Yes. At some point along the way, sometime around there, I also took a class. Then I had started to become interested in it and think maybe I could do this. And I had taken a class at AFI. A sitcom writing thing, I don't know how many, 6 weeks or 10 weeks or something, where you outline, you know, you outline a script, and then you, I remember, like, you spend a few weeks outlining a script and getting feedback, and then the class took a break, and there was, like, I don't know, I think 4 weeks or some ungodly long amount of time where we were all supposed to write our draft. And I did, you know, I left that class and I didn't write. And it was like, you know, it was just like college. It was just like the weekend before. I was like, "God damn it. I bet you a lot of people are going to show up with nothing. And I don't want to be one of them." And I like forced myself, you know, I pulled an all-nighter and wrote a terrible script. And it was a speck of Ellen.
Okay, so the class was writing specs of existing shows.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the Growlings I think the Growlings was just after that. So that was my first foray. And then, I had this agent, Will Forte's agent, who said, write me something.
Rejects your first
Who says,
first
"I can't
attempt."
He said, but you know what? I think that was a really good thing to happen to me, because he wasn't saying, "You suck." And he wasn't saying, "You're not good enough to do this," which was all I was thinking. You know, that's why it took me a year and a half to show him anything. He was just saying, I can't sell this. I can't do anything with this. And I thought that was the right way to, that's the right way to reject someone, right? I mean, it wasn't about me or my ability. Right. It was about the thing I wrote. And he was just like, I'm not going to show this to anyone. I won't be able to do anything with it, and it won't make you look good.
But he was open to reading something else.
But he was like, yeah, keep trying. And then I would call him every once in a while, and I would say, I just want, you know, because I thought, you know what happens to a young writer? And I thought, this is my chance. And I'm blowing it. I'm blowing it as we speak. I'm watching myself blow it, right? Like, because I'm not sending him anything. And then I would call him, and I'd email him, and I'd say, hey, I just want, you know, I'm still here. I'm still working. I'm going to get you something good. And then he said another really smart thing to me, which was, I don't care. He said, Andy, this is your career. You know, I'll help you if I can. I mean, it's really that simple. And it reminded me that this is, there's no one. Yeah.
He's not sitting around waiting for.
He's not worried about me. He's not thinking about me. He is a money-making machine. He knows what to do. If you give him the right thing to sell, he'll go sell it. And eventually I wrote a thing that he liked. And then he got me. And right around that same time, I had also. Oh, God. Andrew, you just started me talking and look at me go. I'm just telling you the whole story.
Yeah, well, that's what we're here for. I want to hear it.
I had started, you know, since this was a second career for mine, I was already getting close to 40. And I was already thinking, you know what? I don't think this is going to happen. I think I'm already too old for this. I think I can't do it. I think I've blown it. Like, I was mad at myself and judging myself. And you go through all these mind games as a writer, as a creative person. You go your brain will destroy you. And you go through all these mind games, and your little voice in your head will tell you all the reasons why you don't deserve this, and why you are right. Who are you fooling?
It's Anne Lamott in Bird by Bird, tuning into K-Fucked, right? Oh, K-F-K-D,
oh,
she talks
yes,
about,
exactly.
Like, you know, you're yep. tuning into K-Fucked,
yep.
and you're listening to, yeah.
And K-Fucked was telling me, like, oh, you know what, you blew it, you waited too long, you know, you can't, you moved to L.A. too old, like, so I went through that whole judgment, and then also, like, the whole thing of, like, okay, you know what, you're a creative person. You know, bring it down to your core values. This is how I call myself, and it's not the smartest way. But I, in my own fucked up way, I have this little sort of method where I go, what is it that you want? What would you pray for if prayer worked? And make sure that it's something that could happen. The example is like, what do I want? I want a job in television, but what do I really want? I want the affirmation. You know, what I really want is the feeling of having that job in television. And there are other ways to get that feeling. So I do this whole thing because I'm, you know, I was also in, I've been sober for 22 years now. And so that was happening right around the same time. So I'm having a spiritual life and I'm telling myself things, you know, I'm working my steps and I'm telling myself, what do you really want? Is that feeling you get when you make someone laugh? You know, that's what we want. That's what we want as creative people. We want to connect with someone. We want to connect with strangers, and we want to feel that we're having an effect on them because we're all introverts and we're all scared of real human interaction. But we want to know that we matter, right? And so I was like, you know what? You can get that feeling whether or not you become a television writer. You can get that feeling. You can just entertain people. And there was this, so what was floating around in my head was I had an idea for a short film that I wanted to make. And so right around the time, I just decided to just make that film.
Okay, I was hoping we were going to get to this because I'm interested. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. When I was goofing around at the Groundlings, you know, improvising with people, a phrase popped into my head. We were imitating, me and this guy, Kevin Ruff, we were imitating John Kennedy. And I was doing a terrible John Kennedy impersonation, that we will get to the moon in this decade. I always love the way he says decade. But I pulled up this bit that me and another friend of mine used to do all the time, which was to imitate, this is terribly politically incorrect, which to imitate John F. Kennedy as a racist, sexist pig. So, you know, it was like, I would like three fine young women delivered to my hotel room. You know, it's that sort of thing. And as I'm riffing with it, I'm like, we will send a white man to the moon by the end of this decade. And so all of a sudden I realized that it kind of came to me fully formed that you could do a fake documentary as if the as if there were a black space program parallel to the white space program, just like in baseball, there was a black, there was a Negro League and a white league. So I had, what I had in my head was the title, The Old Negro Space Program. And I knew, and that title made me laugh. And so I'm sitting there feeling bad for myself, feeling like, you know, oh, you're not going to make it. Oh, and I hadn't written that good script yet. I was just trying, but I was telling my, I was like, you know what you can do is just make this movie. Cause I wasn't a filmmaker, but it was all Photoshop. And I liked playing around in Photoshop. My wife is a graphic designer. And so I had the apps.
Right. You could do the Ken Burns.
I could
effects.
Do the Ken Burns thing till the cows came home. And, so I just produced this. I sort of half produced it. I wasn't done with it yet. And right at the time, and right around that time, I finished that script. I was having, so for that year, I don't know what year it was, 2003, maybe 2002. I was having a very creative year because I had finally, Anne Lamott style, I'd finally just decided to tune out that radio station and just start making things. And results be damned. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just going to do what I'm in control of. I'll just do it. And then.
And have you still got your day job at this point?
I never quit my day job. So I'm working at Gray Advertising at this point, which is on Wilshire and Fairfax, or was. And I'm doing like Pedigree brand pet food commercials. And I'm telling myself, you know what? Here's the thing. That's something to laugh at, but it also it pays pretty well and they love me. And it's like, if this doesn't work out, what have I lost? I got a good job. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a pretty nice cushion there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that freedom, whatever it was, helped me feel creative enough to write a pretty funny script and to make this movie. And so what happened was this agent now had heard about at Malcolm in the Middle, there was an opening in the middle of the season. And they liked a script of mine. And they said, what else does he have? And so Matt calls me and says, they kind of like that script. They ask if you have anything else. And I said, well, I'm not done with it, but I have this movie I'm making. And it had my voice on it as a temp voice track, me doing something I would never, I can't play this for you because I was imitating an old black man. Also the whole movie really shouldn't exist. Like we're in an era now where I honestly do, I would not make that movie today. I think I didn't think about it at the time, or at the time I thought, oh, well, Dave Chappelle can do this, so that means I can do it. But I think in 2022, that doesn't mean I can do it. And
I think I maybe saw it at some point, although I don't know if it was a very long time ago, but fundamentally it is satirizing the racism of that era.
Right.
And so to me, it's just like, you know, I don't know. It's a little bit like when people say, oh, Blazing Saddles, how could you show Blazing Saddles here? Cause I'm like, Blazing Saddles is an incredibly anti-racist movie. Mm-hmm.
But it does
but it has this language and it has some things that are like uncomfortable or sensibilities.
Right.
But at its core, it's a very strong anti-racist movie.
Right.
But it, you know, sometimes that argument is a tough one to make. So yeah, certainly you wouldn't have been making this.
I wouldn't do it today.
What was like Jordan Black and people, you know, Jordan was he Black was in it, right? Was he at Ground? Was he in Groundlings?
Yes.
With you?
I also met him at the Groundlings.
Okay. So he's a brilliant guy.
He is really brilliant. And when I told him the title of this thing, he said, fuck you, which is really the highest compliment any writer can pay another writer.
In a kind of, why didn't I think of that?
In a
you?
Kind of, why like, didn't I? Th- yes, I understood what he meant by that was like, yeah. God damn it.
Okay, so Malcolm in the Middle.
So then he gets sent this. On the strength of those two pieces. On the strength of those two, yeah, send it as a like I sent him a web link to this thing in progress. On the strength of those two pieces, they wanted to meet me, and it was such a great day. God, I'll never forget this. agent called and said, don't get too excited, don't get your hopes up, but they like the script. I'm working, so it's like weeks are going by and I'm hearing that they're thinking about it, blah, blah. And then he said, don't get too excited, but they want to meet you. And here's the deal. They are thinking they might. They want to meet you and they're going to have you pitch some stories. So that's cool. And they were really nice about it. I talked to a guy, one of the upper ups there, Neil Thompson, called and said, are you familiar with the show? Which is a really good question. And I said, I'm getting up to speed as fast as I can.
What season are they in at this point?
Four.
Okay.
And he said, here's the, you know the characters. And I said, yes, of course. And he said, here's the kind of stories we're looking for. So he helped me. He guided me to, like, here's what we want to see from you.
You don't usually get that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm driving there, and my agent calls me on the way to this meeting. And he says, what's your week looking like? And I said, fine. Why? And he said, I don't know. This is what's good about one of the many things I love about my agent is that he has this great court sense. Like he kind of sniffs out where what's happening behind. He reads people really well. The whole story of how he got my script to the showrunner was a pretty good agenting story, actually, because there was a writer there who was vetting material. And he heard that, this writer said to my agent, Andy's at the top of the pile, but he kept not giving it to the showrunner. And my agent sussed out that there's probably something between this writer and the showrunner that isn't functioning. And he was correct. And he further sussed out that he could use the little piece of information that so-and-so loves Andy. He went and ran into the showrunner's Linwood Boomer, and his wife is Tracy Katsky, who was an executive at Fox at the time. So Matt casually drops, runs into Tracy somewhere and says, hey, you should read this guy, Andy Bobrow. So-and-so loves him. Your husband's probably going to hire him. So then he gets my script. So she says, I'll take a look at it. She was reading my script in bed and laughing, and her husband snatches it out of her hands to see what's so goddamn funny.
Wow.
And that was good agenting, right? I mean, that's
great agenting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really understanding the players and how things work.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So he calls me on the way to this meeting and says, what's your week looking like? And I said, what are you sniffing out now? And he goes, I'm getting a weird vibe from them, but I have a hunch it might just go down that they ask you to stay and write a draft. And sure enough, that's what happened. And I think what he figured out was, this happens all the time on network shows, when you've got a 22 episode season, right around Christmas time is when you start to run out of runway. This was like in late November, early December, I think. And what they had, they were in a situation basically where a script was going to have to be written over the holiday break, and
none of the writers wanted to work over Christmas.
And on that show, they were so thorough about their outlining that they felt they could just throw a script to someone who had never written a script professionally before. Mm. And so that's what they did. I went in, I met them, I pitched my stories. They said, oh, this is cool. This is we've done this, or we wouldn't do that. And at the end of the meeting, they were like, well, you seem like a pretty decent guy. They really just wanted to make sure I wasn't psycho. And came off as not psycho enough. And they said, okay, well, so what we're thinking is we have this story that we're sort of in the middle of, and we're probably just going to have you write it. What's your day looking like? And I said, I work here now. And before I knew it, a PA was handing me a lunch menu. And that was my welcome into my first writing job. Lunch menu.
And so they gave you
And then I walked into the room.
Off.
I was scared to death. I sat in the room with them for the rest of that week. I called my boss and told him what the fuck was happening. And I said, I'm so sorry. I had a very good relationship with my boss at that ad agency as well. And he said, take vacation time. Congratulations. Take vacation time. He said, what do you need? And I said, I just need a week and a half. And he said, okay. And so, yeah, I sat in the room while they finished breaking the story and pitching it to the showrunner. And then they sent me off with an outline. The outlines, like I said, the outline of a Malcolm in the Middle episode was longer than the script. It was like reading the Talmud. It was like a paragraph for each scene and then the showrunner's commentary on that paragraph. And it was very well organized. The writer's assistants on that show were great, too. But, yeah. And then over the holiday, I wrote a script, and I turned it in. And they liked it enough. I was also told, like, they're not going to hire anyone. They just want this script. And I was like, okay. He was just setting my expectations. And then they liked it enough, and they said, well, why don't we just – he's funny. We'll just keep him around. So that's how I got
you on as a staff writer for the rest of that season.
For the rest of that season, yeah.
That's – and then you were there one more, how many more years after that?
I did three more years.
Oh, three more years.
Five, okay. Six, and seven. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Wow, it's such a great show. It's funny that I feel like it's not a show that, you know, the kids still, maybe I'm wrong, but it's not a show I hear about kids watching in reruns so much, which is weird because it's so good. It's one of the great pilots of all time.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's that's a good question. Well, you know what? Even my son, I thought I showed it to him when he was around that age, fifth, sixth grade. Maybe I tried too early. I don't know. But he didn't take to it either. And I was this is brilliant.
I know. It really is brilliant. And it's just cool, too, that you're on a show where they did, you know, what you're talking about with those outlines, with that detailed outline. It's something it's quite rare.
Yeah.
But is so key. You know, well-run shows do that.
Absolutely.
And then shows that get into trouble are just kind of like, something like this. And these really skimpy outlines where they think the writer's going to somehow just figure everything out.
Yeah, writer discovery. Yeah.
And then
it's a recipe for disaster.
You get something unusable.
And then the writer feels bad because they're like, well, I got screwed. And then and you don't know how the showrunner is going to respond. Like I've been in that situation as like a number two where I'm like, I know you got screwed. Trust me. We know you got screwed. This is not your fault, but we're rewriting
the
story.
We sent you off half cocked. We sent you off with something that wasn't thought through and you're set up to fail. And and then everyone feels bad. It's just it's incredible how common that is, because I feel like because so many shows work that way, then people come off those shows and they've never been on the show that does it like Malcolm, that knows how to do it. Because Friends, it was a very similar thing. A Friends outline was extremely detailed.
Yeah.
Like in each scene, it was like, here's the shape of the scene. It starts here, this is the next beat of the scene, and then this is the next beat, and it ends here. And
yes,
you really knew. You maybe had a couple jokes that were usable.
Yeah.
And,
So your job writing it is to smooth it out, basically just type it, smooth it out, add whatever jokes you can. My job, I felt like at Malcolm in the Middle, a big part of your job was deciding what to cut from the outline. Like,
because the script would just be way too
long.
Yeah,
it would be 45, 50 pages, and then you'd be like,
Okay. It's Max Fun Drive, people. This is the one time a year where we put a lot of energy into letting you know how you can support this show as a member. So I am here asking you, will you please join us as a member by going to MaximumFun.org/join. All right. I want to thank everyone who's already joined, renewed, upgraded, boosted. Thank you so much. I'm sorry that you have to listen to this pitch. And only you people who have already joined, renewed, upgraded, boosted, you have permission to hit that fast forward button. Everyone else, stick around. Because last week, I said that we have a goal of 550 new or upgrading members. And the sad fact is that as of this day that I'm recording this, here in week two, we are not close to that goal. We are looking like we're not going to make it. Remember, I told you... last week, during last year's Fun Drive, only 7.5% of our listeners became members. Look, we're not looking to get to 100%. I know that's not realistic, but we are looking to up that percentage a bit. And we're looking for 550 people. That's not a crazy number. And I know it's a tough time right now. A lot of things are more expensive. I realize that. But we are not asking anyone to break the bank. We're asking you to support our show for $5 a month. $5 a month, you get all of our bonus content from this year and years past. You'll get access to Weekend Vampire by Steve Agee. If you don't know what that is, you need to join and listen to it, and you'll feel like your money was well spent. So if you go to MaximumFun.org/join, you can join us starting at $5 a month. If you're already a member, you can upgrade to a higher level of membership, or you can boost to an in-between level, or you can even buy someone a gift membership, and that person will also get access to our bonus content, plus the bonus content from every other Maximum Fun show. Like, if you've ever gotten a laugh out of one of our pilots, if you've ever learned something about television or writing or life from one of my interviews with writers, join today. Do it now while it's fresh in your mind. It is good to support the things that you like. Those things tend not to stick around if you don't. So go to MaximumFun.org, MaximumFun.org/join. And now back to my interview with Andy.
You get hired as a staff writer and you just call your boss at the advertising agency back and say, I'm going to need a lot more than a week and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. I did that gig, you know, I wrote that script over Christmas. I went back to work, in January. And it was a couple months. I think it was probably, yeah, it was a month or so before I got the call that they want to just bring you in. And then I made them, they wanted me to start tomorrow, you know, because they're used to, TV shows are used to hiring people who have nothing else going on. Right. They're used to hiring people who are driving past the building when they get the phone call. Yeah. And so I said, you guys, I have to wrap some things up here. I'm so sorry. So I split the difference. I was supposed to give 2 weeks notice and I gave 1 week, and they were the people at Gray Advertising. God bless them. They were so good to me. But my, you know what? I've had guardian angels for many of the important moments in my life. Like, I just, I don't know why. That's just how it's worked for me. People, at crucial moments, people have taken care of me, and I don't know why. Because I don't give back. I don't give a fuck about it.
But this isn't true. You said in an email that you've been making chocolate. You make chocolate for people. Come on, you can't say you don't give back.
That's true. That's true. I do. Yes, I sent everyone chocolate. Wait, did you get? So, did I send you? No, you didn't. I didn't send you chocolate yet. All right.
No, you'll
give me your address and I'll send it.
All right, I need to get some chocolate. How do you think having that job, like, first of all, you know, so an advertising job for most TV writers is like the job you give to a character because you really want to make them a television writer, but the network won't let you do that. So you make them an advertising guy,
right,
even though you don't know anything about how the advertising business works. How do you think it has served you to have had that other career, you know, in your time as a TV writer? Because a lot of TV writers come out of college and, you know, are like a writer's assistant and then get hired and have never really done anything other than be a TV writer.
It's a really mixed bag, because part of me has often thought, I wish I hadn't done that. I wish I had come out of here after college. Basically, my whole peer group is about 8 years younger than me. And so I often go, when I really want to feel sorry for myself, I go, God damn it, I should be 8 years younger. But the flip side of it is, I had been writing professionally, whether you respect copywriting or not. I had been I've been putting words on paper for money, and all that goes with that. The main thing being, here's the story: is like that first script, when I got back into the room at Malcolm in the Middle, and they were prepping it to shoot it, and there was a lot of rewriting going on, and another writer turned to me and said, how does it feel to be like so heavily rewritten? And I said, I've been rewritten by a lot stupider people than you guys.
Yeah. So right. You're not getting rewritten by the folks at Acura.
Yeah, right. Right. Get rewritten by fucking Princess Cruise Lines and then talk to me. having client experience, having white collar experience helped me a lot, because among other things, as an advertising writer, you learn you learn how to make your peace with the fact that it's not going to be what you wanted.
Right. You get all the auteurism beaten out of you.
You get all the auteurism beaten out of you. Yes, yes.
Yeah, which is good to be a TV writer.
I think it helped me. I mean, I am a total suck up, especially with executives. I mean, that's my survival strategy. But also because I genuinely like people that I work with. But I think it does help me. Because even if you're not taking a note, you don't have to be disagreeable. I mean, like it or not, it is a collaboration because they have right. the money.
And you also, you know, it seems like you got a thick skin. You have to have a thick skin. Yeah. You can't take these things personally. And
right.
you have to be able to come back and be reasonable about it. Or,
right, right. You know, also, you go down, what you end up doing, it's like you can complain about this, but it only wastes time. Like you end up going down some blind alleys and then going, I tried this thing that you suggested and it didn't work. Right. But I respect you enough to have tried it. Here's what it looks like. It's I think you agree it's not what we want. Like, let me try something else. So you end up doing a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. So okay, so you stay through season 7 on Malcolm in the Middle.
Oh yeah.
So that's some pretty good experience. So you're there for like 3.5 years.
Yeah.
You're writing a bunch of scripts along the way and
yeah, you know. Yeah. I ended up writing 7 scripts. Is that right? Yeah, I ended up writing 7 scripts at Malcolm.
Okay.
I know that because I get those residuals.
Yeah,
God bless.
Nice.
God bless the WGA.
And why did you leave?
Oh, the show ended. The show ended.
A show is only 7 seasons?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay, so that makes sense. You stayed till the end. Smart,
I stayed till
smart
the
move,
end.
You know?
I was scared to death. The first year, or you know, that first season 4 when I was there and I'd just been hired at the end of the season, I was really sure that I was not coming back, you know, that... Excuse me. I was going to get fired because I didn't know anything. And I'm like, why would they pay me to do this? Like, I kept thinking, it took me quite a while before I had a writing job where I thought, oh, okay, I think even if this one ends, I will get another one.
Okay, so you've gotten to that point. I'm still hoping to reach that point.
I was briefly at that point. I'm not there anymore because I've just had a really, really rough year. But yes, Malcolm ends. Here's what happened. Malcolm ends, and I foolishly think that I'm a mid-level writer on a well-respected comedy. I should be able to go anywhere. I emailed my agent and I said, I really like this show, How I Met Your Mother. I think I would be a good fit there. And he said, let me see. He knew those guys. I got a meeting. They didn't hire me. And I that was like, what? But I'm from Malcolm in the Middle. You know, at post Malcolm, what I found was what I ended up having was something that most of us have, which is. I was lucky that I found work, but it was work on shows that came and went that were forgettable. That you know, they got you know, 12 episode or 6 episode shows,
right.
And really that could have defined me. Except I lucked out and got a job on Community, which was another hugely well respected show that kind of changed how I looked to people.
Right, it's one of those. You know. It's a very cool credit.
It was a cool credit.
I don't know how else to say it. Yep. It's just a cool credit. You're like, yep. Ooh, you know, Community.
Right, right, right.
You know, which is not the, you know, yeah, Sons of Tucson maybe right. doesn't have the same cachet.
Sons of Tucson was a great show,
great,
fun cast.
Yeah.
We did good work. And by the way, the numbers we got on Fox would have been a hit today.
Oh, of course, yes, of
but
course.
Yeah. No one.
Yeah,
no
but it's
one
not like Community. So, when did you get on Community? Were you there from...
Starting in their second season.
Okay.
Yeah. It's funny. I was working at Sons of Tucson with a woman, Robin Shore, who I love. Wait, was she? Yes. Yes, she was at Sons. And she kept talking about a friend of hers who was working on Community who was really not happy. And she said, you guys, I think my friend is going to quit. And I was thinking, who quits a writing job? Like, how bad can it be? Like, I remember thinking, like, tell your friend not to quit. And then her friend ended up quitting, taking care of herself, which, great. God bless her. And then I probably took that job.
And you were there for how many seasons?
I was there for 4 straight years. I did 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Okay.
So I was there for the year Dan Harmon was gone, and then I came, and I was there again for the year he came back.
And yeah, so for people that don't know, you know, Dan Harmon, probably a lot of people know who listen to this do know who Dan Harmon is, but created the show. And yeah, you know, so there's a lot of stories about that show, about it being kind of a wild place to work. I mean, what was it like for you?
It was, I was just telling someone today, because there's a chance I may be going to, be going to work for Dan Harmon again. what it was like was, it was, you know, the hours were insane. That's often all nighters. It was like being in college, you know, and Dan was very nice about it. It was not, I think a lot of people think he was abusive, and I didn't feel that way. I think I'm not talking out of school if I say that he likes to drink. He's pretty public with it, and so it was. We sort of lived like college kids, and he said.
And do you have kids at this point when you're on that show?
I have a small child who is 5 years old when I start that job.
Wow, and you're there all night.
And I remember thinking, oh my God, I remember the Dan was really nice. He said, like, the first time it happened, he said, I'm going to stay all night. No one has to. He would always say, no one has to. And then, of course, we all would, because you feel like, what am I going to be the one who?
Yeah.
Neil Goldman, who was like the number two, Neil and Garrett Donovan, who were the number twos there, they were very good about kind of platooning people. Sometimes, every once in a while, Neil would look across the room at me and say, go home. Like, he would just see the death in my eyes. But yeah, the first time Dan said, the first time I stayed all night, I drove home at 5 in the morning, because I didn't want my son to think that could happen. I didn't want my son to think that dad could go away to work one day and not be there the next morning. So I drove home. And then I ditched that, because it's dangerous to drive home after pulling an all-nighter. So
yeah.
But yeah, it was tough. It was tough. It was tough on my wife. Obviously, you know, this is one of those classic situations where it typically falls onto the woman, to the mom.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of it. But yeah, so yeah.
But yes, in a way, I mean, it's just that there's the powerlessness.
Yeah.
You know, it's not up to you what time you go home.
Right.
And it's also a tricky thing. Whatever, everyone will say, no, these are rich people problems in a way. You're working on a TV show. But it's like, you can never say when you're coming home.
Right.
Like, you just
never
know. And you might, and then there's often like an estimate, but that's wildly off, and then that's frustrating. And it's just like,
it got to a shorthand.
When you're working for someone else, you just don't know.
Right. And it got, for us, it got to a shorthand where I would text her ordering dinner. I would text her if we were ordering dinner, and then I would text her if it was going to be even later than 11 p.m. And then it got to a shorthand where it would just be OD stood for ordering dinner, which I thought was a really good shorthand for. I would just say OD, and then she would say, fuck this.
Yeah, she was probably not a Dan Harmon fan.
No, no. And every year and every season on hiatus, you know, towards the end of every season, I would have this talk with my wife, and I would say, I think this is probably it. I don't think I can go back next year. It's just, I love the show. It's just too exhausting. And she'd be like, you think? And then every hiatus, you know, a month would go by, like the pain of childbirth dissipating. And I would say, you know what? Here's the thing. I'm going on meetings to work on other shows. I'm seeing what's out there. And there's just nothing that makes me as happy as that show. So that's really, that was the reality of Community. It was very hard. It was very physically taxing. And I have never felt more creatively fulfilled than when I worked there. I'm so grateful that I did work there. I learned everything about structure from him. It's like, you know, the guy's a genius. He's just hard to be around.
and do you use, I've talked to other writers,
the story
about
circle,
the story circles, and do you use that? So story circles is sort of Dan Harmon's version of Joseph Campbell, I guess. You know, it's a sort of way of thinking and structuring story.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you use in your writing since then?
Yeah, it's sadly, it infected my brain. It's dangerous when you tell someone there's a hack for writing a story, for structuring a story, because there really isn't. And the story circle is, you know, the hero's journey or any method you want to use. It's just a way of codifying what you know instinctively or what ends up feeling right. But I definitely use, I mean, the points on that story circle that I always gravitate to are I've actually boiled down for my students. I've boiled the story circle down to three beats. One is fuck it, we're doing this. That's the end of act one. Fuck it, we're doing it. If you look at Community episodes, most of them involve Jeff Winger or someone saying fuck it, we're doing this. And the fuck it implies that there was a refusal of the call just moments before, right? So fuck it, we're doing this is the end of act one. The end of act two is, oh shit, everyone hates me. And then and then act three is, how do I get out of this? How do I redeem myself and get out of this? That's the basic elements of the story circle that I've kept.
And sorry, you just said your students.
Oh, I taught a class at UCLA. I've done it twice now. I taught a pilot writing class.
Oh, nice.
A seminar. So I'm not a teacher. I learned that for sure in the first time I did it. I got a little better the second time I did it. But yeah, I have a handout where I go, here's all you need to know about the story circle. Fuck it. Let's do this. Oh shit, everyone hates me. Bonus points for oh shit, everyone hates me, and I'm stuck in a dumpster with them. And then act three is like apologies and hugs.
How do I redeem myself? I like this. Yeah. This is, I'm writing this down.
Write it down.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
you know, there's a lot of these things that, for, you know, David Mamet's got his, you know, who wants what from whom,
sure.
What happens if they don't get it and why now.
Yeah.
And sometimes with sitcoms, it's not like something like this is actually more applicable to like a, you know, a half hour comedy.
Yeah.
Like what the beats are going to be. You're not writing some heist movie. You're not writing, you know,
right.
So it's like certain kinds of beats don't apply.
Right. Yeah. Fuck it. We're doing this.
Yeah.
That's a fine end of act one. And no one calls you on it. If every episode of your whole series ends the same act one, the same way, no one will call you on it. They'll be like, yeah, it's a delightful show.
Yeah. That's why I like that beat. And I liked the last episode of the show that I like, yeah. And I'm going to like it now. So then after that, that's when you get, so you've been in touch with Will Forte, I assume, since the Groundlings. You guys have stayed in touch. Is that, you know, the Last Man on Earth gig comes about through your relationship with him, or did it not, or is that just coincidence?
We had not been in touch. We didn't have a falling out or anything. We sort of like each other, but we weren't really friends. And he had gone on to, so I mean, I had, I would run into him every once in a while, but no, as Community was ending, I went to my agent and said, what I say to him periodically, am I done? Like, will anyone hire me ever again? Have I aged out yet? Is this over? Like, is the ride over? And so I was having that conversation with him, and he said, well, your buddy Will Forte just sold a show. You should reach out to him. You know, I'll tell him you're available, but you should reach out to him. And I said, I haven't talked to him in a long time, and I think I have a bad email address for him because it says Earthlink. and then our agent said, nope, that's still the one. So I emailed Will. I said, hey, Matt just told me you sold the show, and he leaked me the script of it, and it's amazing and I love it, and I want to be a part of it any way I can possibly, whatever. And Will said, let's have breakfast. So we met, and he sat down. It was the easiest thing in the world. We sat down, and he said, well, job's yours if you want it. Like, we did, there was no interview or anything. It was just like, we just caught up with each other, and he knew. Once again, I think had Community not happened, Will Forte would not have said that to me. Mm-hmm. I think Community proved a certain credibility, and he knew me from before, and he knew I was funny. But yeah. It's the easiest goddamn. man.
Oh.
And the that other is, huge piece of advice, don't make enemies.
Right.
Turn send chocolate to people.
Yeah.
Turn everyone into a friend.
No, that is definitely good advice, and it doesn't matter who they are.
It doesn't matter who they are, especially your assistant or the PA on the show
the
where
PAs.
You were. Those
right,
people, that person's going to sell a show.
Yeah, or that person, you know, or the assistant at the network is going to be the head of comedy.
Yes,
and you
yes.
better not have been a dick to that person.
Oh, my God, yes.
But that's another one. The Last Man on Earth is another one of the all-time great pilots.
So just... lucky. See, yeah, a really great pilot. And that was all Will. I mean, I got to, you know, I feel like my brand is being good enough to be around really good people. I think that's kind of where I'm at. But yeah, Will's just, no one thinks like him. He's gifted.
And, and just such incredible twists on that show that, mm-hmm. that kept coming.
Yeah.
You know, just
yeah.
these brilliant twists. I'm back. Hey, we actually recorded a table read for a future episode just this morning. And it really reminded me of everything I love about making this show. We had such a great group of actors. Some actors you would all know. Some just getting started. Some people I didn't know. All such cool, talented people there to help bring to life something that had been left for dead. And the writers for the pilot, not super seasoned veterans with like huge list of credits, but incredibly talented people who wrote a really smart, fresh, high-quality pilot that didn't get shot. And the thrill that they felt at getting to hear it read aloud by this talented cast, I mean, I could see it on their faces and hear it in the way they talked afterwards. It's just pure joy. And it's a big part of why we do this show. And no one else does what we do. There's 1 trillion podcasts out there competing for your attention. Only Dead Pilot Society does this. So we go away and these pilots are just dead forever. And, you know, if you're here listening, you get why we do it. So please go to MaximumFun.org/join right now. You know, like I said, we're behind on our goal. But you can help us get there. For $5 a month, you get all of our bonus content. You know, I just saw someone on Twitter say that it's definitely worth $5 a month just to hear Steve Agee's Weekend Dracula whenever you want. Don't know what I'm talking about? Join. Check it out. Hey, do you like Ted Lasso? We have a pilot by Bill Lawrence, one of the creators of Ted Lasso. That's only available as bonus content to our members. For $10 a month, you get a dead... Also, you know, you get the video of all of our Zoom raids, which is really cool. I mean, Greatest American Heroes last week with Will Forte and Sam Richardson and Stephen Root. I mean, you want to see those people's faces. So that's $5 a month to get the bonus content. For $10 a month, I love this Dead Pilot Society patch that you get at $10 a month. It's just really cool. White patch. It's got this vintage RCA test pattern on it. I'm going to put it on something. You're going to want to put it on something. It's genuinely cool. Also really cool, when you join or upgrade to the $20 a month level, you can choose between our Max Fun Creativity Pack or a Rocket Hat. So artist and Max Funster Ellen Vandermeide illustrated a beautiful deck of 54 cards in this Max Fun Inspiration Deck. So each card has an activity suggestion from your favorite hosts or your pals at Max Fun, designed to inspire you to enjoy friends, nature, food, you time, art. It's going to be great for the next lockdown. You're going to need this. Kit also comes with a set of 3 postcards, a piece of non-hardening modeling clay, and a custom Blackwing pencil to encourage you to make your thing. There's a suggestion from me in there. I think it's a good one. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but you can find out if you pledge $20 a month and get that inspiration deck. If you're not into that creativity pack, you can opt for the Max Fun Drive Rocket Logo Hat. It's an embroidered eco-friendly cap with an adjustable back. It's a good looking hat. You'll also receive at that level your choice of patch, a letterpress membership card, all that bonus content. There's gifts at higher levels too. There's a really cool messenger bag at $35 a month, but joining or upgrading at any level will go towards our goal of 550 new or upgrading members. So please,
please, while you're thinking of it, which is right now while you're listening to me, go to MaximumFun.org/join. Do it now. Now back to me, Andrew, talking to Andy.
So, okay, so now we're getting closer to finally to talking about the pilot we read, because you, did you meet
Phil
Lord and Chris Miller Last Man on Earth?
Yes.
Because they were executive producers of that and directed the pilot.
And, once again, proving that this is a relationship business. You know, it's like, so they had a pretty good, you know, they basically, Will vouched for me. You know, they liked Will, and Will said, I like Andy, and that's how I got that job.
The greatest American Hero.
No,
job.
I'm sorry.
No, that's how you got the last man on earth job. Yes.
Well, okay. I'm sorry. So Will
signed off.
Gave it to me.
Will, yeah. Right. Will, yeah. You know.
Yeah. And so I'm working there, and I got a field promotion. You know, I was working there as a co-executive producer, and then I got promoted to. I got a title bump because I was kind of I was the number two person. Will really, really wrote and that show is his, but I was sort of keeping the train running. That was my job there, and making sure that he had what he needed. And so while I was there, their executive Seth Cohen came to me and said, "Do you have any interest in writing The Greatest American Hero?" 20th got the rights to it, and they're seeing if they want to reboot it, and they're talking to Phil and Chris about it, and so they're in early discussions looking for a writer. And I knew of the show, I knew what it was, but I hadn't watched it when it was on. And then so I took a look at the pilot, and I had two thoughts very immediately. One was, this is dumb, this is a cheesy show.
Yeah. Yes.
And two, well, that's fantastic. That's such an opportunity, you know, because 21 Jump Street was dumb and cheesy, and Phil and Chris made magic with it. And so if anyone can do it, they can, or they could guide me. And I just thought, the wheels just started turning instantly, because I thought, well, if I were to try to overcome this dumb thing, you know, how would I preserve the mythology? How would I upgrade it? And it came pretty quickly. And so the next day I went to him. And honestly, the whole solution in my head was Alias. My big invention was the reboot of Greatest American Hero should be like Alias. That was kind of that was what I thought. I still believe that. I believe it should be an hour. They've tried to reboot it a couple times as a half hour, and every time they do it, I'm like, you guys are, you're not going to like it. It should be an hour. It needs to be an hour. It's an action show. The action has to be good. But anyway, so yeah, then I went right back to Seth and I said, yeah, I would like to try to do this. And he said, I'm so sorry I misspoke, or I spoke too soon, or I didn't have the right information, but they have already got a writer. And when we did the table read, by the way, I misspoke. I said they hired Cary Fukunaga. But that was racist of me, because it was another Asian-sounding last name, Rick Famuyiwa.
Okay.
apologies to everyone for that.
The writer-producer of the old Negro space program cannot be making mistakes like this.
Holy moly. So yeah, he said it's too late. They've hired this writer director, Rick Famuyiwa, who's great. And at the time, he had just done this movie, Dope, that was a indie darling,
right?
And was really great and stylish and fantastic. And I was like, oh yeah, that's who they should. Yeah, that's a great idea. They should do that. And then, like I said, that project didn't go anywhere. I'm not sure how far it got. I never heard another thing about it. So I don't know if there was a script. I don't think there was a pilot. We would have read about it if there was something shot.
Yeah. I think only the Hannah Simone one was shot.
Yeah. And there was there was another one in between those two. They tried it with Rick Famuyiwa. It didn't go anywhere. They tried it, I believe, with someone else. I'm not sure how far that got, but also didn't go anywhere. And then I couldn't get it out of my head, and I thought I need a new sample. So I just I wrote it. It took me a while. I got mad at myself, like I do. It took me way longer than I thought. It took me, I think, two hiatuses. Like, you know, you go
because you had to write all those stage directions.
Yes, exactly, all those stage directions.
You're not used to. Us comedy writers aren't used to writing so many stage directions.
You're not kidding. I had the hardest time with the frickin' stage direction writing action. I ended up reading a lot of J.J. Abrams scripts to figure out how he writes action.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good at it.
Yeah, there are people who are really good at it.
Yeah. And so I wrote this thing on spec because what I thought was they wanted to reboot it with a non-white lead character, which they definitely should do. And because of that, it's going to be hard for them to hire a white guy to write it, which it should be. And so I thought, well, if I have an idea. And I want people to see it. And I'm not. And I don't even know if people are going to want me to pitch it to them. So I just thought, well, I'll just write it. I'll just write it and then see. Also, because I was pretty sure everyone wanted it as a half hour, and I was the only smart person who wanted it as an hour.
Well, I think there's a thing where they're used to, you know, the comedic one hour.
Yeah.
Was, you know, the A Team and all these shows. You know, it used to really be a thing.
And
it's so completely gone away. It's extremely hard to sell. I mean, that's every now and then they'll make one. My friend Lindsay Shockley shot one a few years back that was, you know, not totally dissimilar to this. It was kind of in the vein of Spy or The Spy Dumped Me. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's an action comedy and it was really funny. And I think they just they're reluctant to put these comedic one-hours on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably naive of me too. And cause that's an hour of, you know, when you think about it, the network primetime schedule, that's a fixed number of hours. Like there's only, there's only 3 hours a night. It's like and Andy Barber is going to eat up a whole hour of it. No. What has he done? So I wrote it on spec and then I showed it to I told my agent I've done this, and he said, okay, cool. Let's figure out what to do with it. He kind of leaks it to Michael Thorne at Fox. And Michael says, this is really good. Sadly, the timing is off yet again because we've just engaged. I don't know who the writer was, but they just had closed the deal for that project that ended up being Hannah Simone doing it in a half hour, which was a smart move. I mean, they really should have done that, and they did it. And I heard it turned out good. I don't know why.
Well, I saw it. It was good. You know, it's very different from yours. Uh-huh. But it was very likable because you know she's so good.
Yeah.
And I think it had a little bit of a similar, you know, kind of a fuck up character.
Yeah.
Ends up in the suit, who's just like the last person who you would think. You know, so it's going to be a redemption story of someone who's kind of screwed up, but has a chance. And, I think in her case, it was more just, you know, like a party girl. You know, it may just be, I mean, the problem may be people are not totally clamoring for a reboot of
That's a funny thing that happens. Yes. I talked to my friend Emily Spivey about this a lot. Things that I'm nostalgic for. Who remembers Greatest American Hero? People who are over 40 now, right? I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
it's not the desired audience.
But I guess aren't those the people watching network television? So
I suppose so. I suppose so.
I mean, that's what I mean. To me, if it made sense, it's because network TV realizes their audience is older. You know, super young people are not watching network TV. And
right.
So if they're looking at their audience and thinking like, oh, these are the people who, you know, whatever, the Wonder Years. These are people who remember the Wonder Years. So let's just redo the Wonder Years. It just seems like, well, those people also probably watch Greatest American Hero.
Yes.
Or Knight Rider or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, so, but that, so.
It could also be that it was just that ABC looked at, it also might just be one of those things where, what were we thinking? This isn't our brand. Like, I don't know. It's on paper, it seems like, ABC should be able to run that show, but maybe it just didn't look right on their schedule in between family half hours. like maybe it just didn't fit there. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, I've talked about this with so many people on the show where it comes down to, okay, you know, we're looking at a schedule and your show that you've slaved over every, you know, joke and,
yeah,
you know, comes down to comedic 1 hour. I don't think we're looking for comedic 1 hour.
Right.
So it doesn't matter, you know, how good right, it is. Right, it right. doesn't matter. Like, it no, we matter. We feel
it's
like
a
we
widget.
Need we need a legal show.
Yeah.
So we need legal show here, and your show is comedic 1 hour.
Yep.
So sorry, and that's you know it comes down to that. So
yeah.
all the scrutiny and endless you know, second guessing of this line and this beat. Yeah. When it comes down to decision makers, nope. We wanted medical show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you weren't medical show.
Oh,
but,
God.
But was so it fun? I mean, you know, it's the only 1 hour we've done on Dead Pilot Society. We bent a couple rules for you, Andy.
Thank you. I really
because
appreciate
I guess it.
It
was like, you know, we've never done a 1 hour and we've never, you know, it's usually shows that were officially sold and developed at networks, which in this case is
you were really desperate
enough.
For material, weren't you?
Yeah. I don't know what we were thinking. But was it, you know, it's very different from other things. I mean, in a way, you know, you had to write this sort of action movie kind of thing. And was that fun? Was it to leave you? Is that something you want to do more of? Was it like, oh, Jesus, I don't want to write those stage directions again?
No, I'll tell you what goes through my head also as a hustler and a person who's trying to find work in this new universe is that a lot of, you know, all the Marvel movies, a lot of what's happening in features is they're all comedic. And so I keep thinking, oh, that should be a muscle that I exercise. Like I should be able, I mean, it's something that I actually hope to prove to, that this podcast will help, help me with is to put myself into a consideration set where someone goes, oh, this person who came from comedy could get the action good enough, but who knows, maybe I didn't, I probably didn't.
Because you're right, because you know the Avengers movies are workplace comedies,
yeah,
for a lot of their running time are just this workplace comedy, and they're I don't know how those movies are written, but I'm sure they're bringing in a lot of people to punch up that stuff, and they're bringing in comedy people to just do the banter, among them. And and you're right, it's always good to show, well, okay, you know, I can also do this. Here's a sample for this kind of thing, you know.
Right. Just
and I guess on Community, you did so many different kinds of episodes. That
yes, I mean that's the thing. There are people. Well, look at Chris McKenna, who is really, really gifted, was able to get very, very high up in the action movie writing universe.
Yeah. He wrote the last Spider-Man movie. That's the only movie that's done well.
Yeah.
In the
last
2 years.
Because he knows what he's doing. The whole team does. And we did, because we did genre stuff, there were directors who did Community episodes. Well, I don't know if this is apocryphal, but I thought I heard that the Russo brothers were only considered for those movies because of the parodies that they, or the, you know, the genre stuff that they had done on Community. I don't know. I'm just spreading rumors now at this point.
I don't know, but it's true. I mean, those are comedy, you know, those are just sitcom directors. I mean, not sitcom, but half-hour comedy directors who are now like the biggest action movie directors on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was it like hearing, I mean, this incredible cast, which you really were very instrumental
in
putting together. I just sort of sat back and just heard like, oh, we got Steven Root. Like, this is amazing. But then, I mean, how was it for you to hear those people, you know, read this?
It wasn't great. I'll be honest. Like, I don't know how, I hope it came out good. Cause on Zoom, it's always hard. And there were times when I thought, oh, this is bombing or this is slow. So I don't know. Maybe it works better
because you're a writer. And of course you might feel that way.
But there are definitely one thing that was really very, very informative and will make my next action script much better is that I did feel where it was lagging. And I knew instantly where I overdid the action. And so lesson learned there. But in general, it was amazing hearing Sam Richardson do that stuff. I mean, yeah. He can make anything funny. And as soon as Ben did.
I think Ben Blacker got Sam.
That was like, I just was like, well, I mean, you know, my dream would be Sam Richardson, but we can't get Sam Richardson. And Ben was
Sam's a friend of Dead Pilot Society. He's done it a number of times.
Oh my God, what a gift.
Always is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was amazing hearing him do that. Getting Will Forte, I felt bad asking Will because I've worked with him now and I know that he says yes to things. And I knew it was like, you have no idea like how I looked at that text for how many minutes I looked at that text before hitting send, because I knew what I was doing was that he wouldn't be able to say no. And that
I think he had. And he's he's done Dead Pilot Society before.
OK, good. All right. So, good.
Chris McKenna's wife. I think it was her show. Sally Bradford. McKenna's show.
Excellent.
And it's a fun part, you know. I mean, well, that trend part is.
And I made some adjustments for him. You know, once he got it, once he said yes, I did. I was like, okay, well, now I want to give him something he'll have more fun doing. So I sort of did a little tweaking. I hope that's okay.
Here's a comedy nerd question for you. So there's the bit in the pilot where he's got the earwig and is getting the answers to the sort of code,
yes,
which is very much like a bit in the Mary Tyler Moore pilot.
Is it really?
Yes, where it's just like it's Mary and Lou Grant, and there's like a question. It's a bit where there's like a sort of a question behind.
God!
It's not like you stole it. It's just sort of. It reminded me because it's one of the all-time great.
Oh,
bits.
I gotta go watch that. I will confess that I stole it. I completely stole it because it. I'm pretty sure it was done earlier than that, because what I stole it from was an old British sketch show called The Two Ronnies. And I filed that thing away. Like, I know it's dicey. Like, I know, like, there was part of me that said, oh, this is probably too much stealing. And there was another part of me that said, or is it homage? I'm not sure.
homage.
There's a sketch. Yeah. Look up The Two Ronnies. And their sketch was basically, it's a game show, where the premise of the game show is you have to answer the question that was previously asked. So anyway, and then that's a punchline machine. You know, once you've set up that game, it's a punchline machine. And I just thought, oh, this is math. I mean, I love doing this. I want to use this somewhere. I wonder if I could disguise it enough that people would think it was mine. But no, of course I can't. That is such a...
It's such a perfect bit that it's probably been used even more times than the ones we're thinking of.
Oh my God. Thank you for telling me about the Mary Tyler Moore thing. Oh
yeah,
my
go
God.
Back and look at that.
I gotta see it.
It's worth every now and then just looking at the Mary Tyler Moore pilot anyway, because it's just so perfect. So tell me what you're up to now.
Working on this animated show, Bless the Hearts, that was 2019, 2020. That got canceled. And this is, honestly, I think, hopefully it's good for me to discuss this, but it's a little painful. But I've had the worst year of my life work-wise. I've had a fine year life-wise. I'm okay. No one cry for me. I haven't worked all year. I think my last paycheck was November of 2020. So it's been a really interesting time, you know. And I can blame COVID. What is this disease called? I can blame COVID for a lot of it. But I do have those feelings like, oh, maybe I'm aging out. Like, I don't know. Maybe this is happening now.
I think it is good for you to discuss this because this is a reality of this job. It happens. And no one talks about it. And there's like this, and you know, I can hear it as you're talking. There's like shame involved with it.
Yeah.
It's just the way it goes.
It's the way it goes. And I didn't realize, well, I did realize, but I've been so blessed that I can't believe that, humble brag, that I worked 18 seasons of television in a row without having a year off.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the blessing. But yeah, I finally had my year off, and now I'm going crazy.
But you're doing.
No, I'm like, wait, this isn't supposed to happen to me. I worked on Community. I have a good credit.
I have a cool credit.
I have a cool credit. This doesn't happen to cool credit guys.
It's critics, darling. But you said you're doing a podcast.
I'm doing a podcast. Yes, yes, and I want to plug it. I made a podcast. My quarantine lockdown hobby was learning how to make my own chocolate from beans, which I'm very good at, and I really am toying with turning it into a business. My plan is, of course, to get it to influencers like you.
Okay. All right, I'm getting some of this chocolate. Just put my address in the chat here.
My other lockdown hobby was this podcast, and it started with I have a good friend, Andy Stanton, who is a British guy who writes children's books. He wrote a book series that's incredibly that was very, very popular in England called Mr. Gum. And we were paired up by Tracy Katsky, who appeared earlier in this discussion. When she was a development executive at Nickelodeon, they had optioned his children's books, and they were shopping for a writer. I met him over the phone. We had instant chemistry. Our pilot didn't go anywhere, but we've stayed friends. And we are doing a podcast that we were just goofing off one day, which is how all the best things happen. And we started talking about this British TV show that may or may not be real. And it turned out, we just were basically riffing as if we were huge fans of this show. And we decided, we've done a podcast now.
A fan podcast of a
fictional show. It's called the Tumblr's Willy Podcast. It'll be out by the time this airs. We're dropping it on March 15th.
Okay.
You can find it on all podcast channels. Starburns Audio is our network. And we do a deep, deep dive into the long storied history of a show called Tumblr's Willy, which is the longest running TV show in world history. Everyone in the UK knows this show. They were raised on it. Ask anyone in England, in all of the Isles, about Tumblr's Willy. They all know it. It started in radio. It started in 1902. The first episode of Tumblr's Willy was a full hour of silence because they forgot to hire an engineer. And as you can imagine, England went crazy for it. It was an instant hit. There are lots and lots of ups and downs. We go decade by decade through the long history of Tumblr's Willy. It's still going. It's still going strong. And so tune in. Look for the Tumblr's Willy podcast. That's my plug.
So that's great. I mean, so like I think you just have to adjust your thinking. It doesn't. It's not a paycheck, but it's not like you're not creating something new.
Yes. Andy and I and other writers and I have these discussions all the time, and now I'm having it with you. And it goes back to the thing that I was saying about the old Negro space program. It's like, well, what do I do? What do I really want? I want to be creative and touch people and get laughs. And so sometimes that pays an insane amount of money, and those are really lucky years. And sometimes it doesn't pay anything. But yeah, you don't get the money unless you do that. There's a 0% chance you'll get paid if you aren't making something funny, so you might as well just make funny things, right?
Yeah, and you never know what can come from it, and it keeps you fresh. Just did an interview with another writer who's just it's like, I just try to every couple of years do something where I have no idea what I'm doing, and it's just like, yeah, it's a great thing to stay creative. We all kind of worry, are we aging out? Are we getting too old? But you never will if you keep doing,
Right.
It's just not I do it too, so I completely understand. God. I'm talking to myself as much as you, but it's
what
it's
are you
not
up
a useful
to? Wait,
thing.
You've, what are you up to? How's your year been?
It's been, you know, the COVID was also, you know, certainly not my highest earning years either, Andy. Well, I don't usually talk about what I'm doing. I'm writing a pilot with my best friend for ABC, which is fun because we haven't worked together since high school.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, so that's, you know, it's been really fun working with him. It's always, writing a network pilot, it's always got its ups and downs.
Right,
but,
right.
We're doing that. And then, you know, I directed this music documentary, which is getting close to being done, which
is cool.
You know, just like what I was talking about, you know, something I had no idea. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And mm-hmm. it's just pure labor of love. And it's taken me a very long time because I had to sort of invent the wheel.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, didn't know how to do it. But it's been fantastic. I mean, it's just been, you know, rewarding in a way that, you know, that, mm-hmm. writing another pilot might not have been.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's just flexing different muscles, and it's just been this really great thing. But again, it's pays negative dollars.
It pays negative dollars. Yeah. Yeah. Money gets removed.
Yes, money gets removed. But, you know, and for everyone, I think anyone who's acting like they've just been killing it during this last couple of years of COVID is lying, and just lying in a really nefarious way.
Yeah.
It's just, we all feel bad about ourselves
yeah.
already.
Yeah,
so
don't do
we
this
don't
to
need
us.
People. Anyway, well, look, Andy, this was great. It's been great getting to meet you and talk. And,
yeah,
you know,
too.
And hear, like, a person who actually made the leap from advertising to television writing. It's such a, you know, thing you hear about, but you know, there, people actually
yep.
exist.
Yep, I really did it,
and it's a really fun pilot, and I'm glad people are getting to hear it with this
yeah,
incredible
I'm
cast.
Really glad people are getting to hear it. Absolutely.
All right, so we're gonna sign off, and I'm gonna get you my address so I can get some of your chocolate.
Nice. Milk. All right,
and I can't wait to hear the podcast. So thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Okay, that was my conversation with Andy Bobrow. And I'm here to ask one more time that you become a Maximum Fun member. This is the last time I'll ask for this whole year. When I think about who I do this show for, you know, there's a lot of answers that come to mind. You know, it's for the comedy fans who want to laugh at comedies that they can't see or hear elsewhere. It's for TV fans who are exhausted by this peak TV and all this prestige TV and committing to these multi-season shows and wants something that's just one episode. You know, it's for people interested in how the television business really works. It's for would-be writers who want to know how to actually get to be a television writer. And it's for people, maybe writers, maybe not, who have been made to feel less than. And I, you know, this is a group I think about a lot. People who've been made to feel less than because they haven't achieved the success that they think they should have. Now, these people could be just starting out, or they could have a list of credits a mile long on IMDb. These feelings are not specific to people just starting. I can tell you that for sure. And those people can hear from writers like Adam McKay or Jenji Cohen or John Hodgman about their pilots that were rejected and know that this is part of having a career as an artist. So we're here partly to take away the stigma. It's not embarrassing to have a dead pilot. It's worthy of celebration, and that's what we do here. We celebrate them. As I've said, we've got our goal of 550 new and upgrading members. You know, this show takes a lot of work by a small group of very busy people, myself included. We love doing it, but if we're gonna keep doing it, if we're gonna keep doing all this work of finding these scripts and casting them and recasting when people fall out, and, you know, trying to put together these amazing casts and editing these shows, you know, if we're gonna keep doing this, we need to know that we have a supportive audience. We need to know we have an audience that values what we're doing and is willing to show that they do by donating starting at $5 a month. It's just a little less than the price of a gallon of gas. Once a year, we have to come to you and ask for your support. So please help us hit our goal. Give it $5 a month, get all the bonus content. Give it $10 a month, get the incredibly cool Dead Pilot Society patch. Give it $20 a month, get the creativity pack or the hat. $35 a month, get the messenger bag. Whatever you do, at whatever level, please, be a part of that fraction of the audience that decides that this show has value to them and that they want to support it and make sure that it keeps going. So go to MaximumFun.org/join. And on behalf of myself, my Dead Pilot Society producing partner, Ben Blacker, our associate producer, Noah Findling, and our editor, Jordan Katz, we thank you so much. I'm Andrew Reich. Thank you for listening and for considering supporting us by becoming a member at MaximumFun.org/join.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.